And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT, 89.5 FM. And off the top, I'll tell you how grateful we are for all the support given to our program and to the great station, CIUT. And to remind you, as I have been telling you, that you can still donate online, CIUT.FM. And when you do, remember the Taylor Report. And I called out a lot of names. I hope I said Barry and Jean, because they did a lot of have given us a lot of support to our program over the years. We're going to talk today to James Bissette, who was a former Canadian ambassador to Yugoslavia. We're also going to talk about the subject of non-alignment and neutrality, which used to interest Canadians, with Norman Richmond. And later at the end of the show, we're going to talk to Keith Ellis, poet and translator, about Eduardo Galeano. And I think, though, we are joined now by Mr. James Bissette. Are you there, sir?
I am, yes.
Well, thank you very, very much. You have, of course, you're the most qualified to be talking about this subject, that is international law and the role of diplomacy. You had a very clear, it seemed to me, article in the Toronto Star. It was published Sunday, March 29, is the one I saw. They titled it, "Why Bombing Syria Breaks the Law." And for you, this opened up an entire question of how Canada and the United States, particularly, have, I guess a kind word would be to say, wandered a little bit away from the UN Charter and international law. Let's start with Syria. What's your concern there?
Well, my concern is that, as you have said, I was on the ground in Yugoslavia when the first violation of the charter took place. Mm-hmm. By the United States and by NATO, actually. And I was disappointed then. In fact, I was very concerned about that, because even the Russians hadn't really done that since the end of the Second World War. And I thought it was setting a bad precedent. And I see it really as almost a turning point in history. And I was worried, as were a lot of other people, that the bombing of Serbia, which was a violation of the Charter and of, as you say, international law, and certainly a violation of Article 1 of the North Atlantic Treaty Association, mm-hmm. which said pretty clearly, as I mentioned in my article, that NATO was a defensive organization. It was there to defend the West against at that early time, peril of Stalin's Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. But it made it clear in its first article that NATO would never use force, or indeed even threaten to use force, in the resolution of international disputes.
By the way, I'm glad you raised that issue. It seems we have drifted so much. It's not only a matter of violating sovereignty or being aggressive and using force, but threatening to use force is supposed to be noted and condemned, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And, the Article 1 also went on to say NATO would always act in accordance with the United Nations Charter. I mean, this was as I say, the UN Charter came. I mean, a lot of people are critical of the United Nations today, and I'm one of them. It doesn't mm-hmm. seem to be able to do an effective job in many areas, and particularly in its primary area, which is to secure peace and stability in the world. Mm-hmm. But it's the only thing we've got, and it was an important institution and still is. And it mm-hmm. arose, out of the reality that we'd made a total mess of the 20th century before the century was halfway through. We'd had two major world wars with mm-hmm. terrible casualties and killing and destruction, and we'd also used the atomic bomb on Japan mm-hmm. on two occasions. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the war, those people who participated in that part of the first part of the century realized that if the century in an age of nuclear bombs, mm-hmm. and terrible weapons, if the world was going to survive, it had to get one simple principle straight, and that was that we mustn't use force in the resolution of our international disputes. It's as simple as that. And one would think it's fairly easy.
Yeah. Well,
but it wasn't easy, and I mean...
Yeah, well, you mentioned, people do, this is, of course, true of almost every kind of parliamentary body or whatnot, people get frustrated. But provided the main principles are adhered to, it's certainly a livable frustration, right? But, I mean, you can't win every argument, you can't win every vote.
No, that's right. But, it was the Western powers, the NATO countries, particularly the United States, certainly in Canada and England, Britain, mm-hmm. that stood, on moral authority, that they did believe in these principles of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness and freedom and mm-hmm. the rule of law, and the principles outlined in the Charter. Mm-hmm. So I found it a very sad thing that we would violate that. And violated in a very nasty way, because, first of all, with all of Milosevic's faults, and I knew him quite well, he was essentially a banker. He wasn't a warlike person. He didn't have designs of greater Serbia. That's all, mm-hmm. Part of the propaganda campaign. He was trying to protect his own country from an armed rebellion of Albanians mm-hmm. in the Serbian province of Kosovo that had been armed, equipped, and financed by the United States.
Yes. I recall his participating in conferences. I think it was in Pittsburgh, wasn't it? I mean, everybody was there.
Oh, yeah.
And it was everyone thought, well, okay, now we have the basis of a resolution. And instead, it turned into a conflagration.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, they'd armed the KLA that they themselves, I'm talking about the Americans, had the year before declared to be a terrorist organization. And these KLA fighters would go back into Kosovo, assassinate Serbian mayors, shoot Serbian police, and started an armed rebellion. Milosevic was simply trying to put that down. Now, granted, mm-hmm. some of the tactics of the Serb security forces were pretty nasty, but there was no genocide in Kosovo, and mm-hmm. there was no mass ethnic cleansing. That was all fabricated mm-hmm. and followed, unfortunately, by the Western media.
Yes.
They demonized Milosevic, who at one point was their dearest friend. At one point, I think Madeleine Albright was wanting to nominate him to, Times Magazine of the Year, the Man of the Year.
Well, I can remember when Tito was, we loved Tito. Tito was a pal of Nixon and Eisenhower and everybody. They all thought he was a marvelous guy.
But that bombing went on for 78 days and nights. They used cluster bombs. They used mm-hmm. bombs with depleted uranium. They destroyed the civilian infrastructure of a neighboring country, allied of ours in both First and Second World War, and not a threat to any of their neighbors. They were simply trying to maintain their sovereignty.
Yeah.
Then when the war did end, which ended primarily because German public opinion got tired of the bombing. They'd had enough of it of their own. But the Germans put pressure on the Americans to eventually call in the UN and the former Russian prime minister to try and resolve it. And mm-hmm. they met with Milosevic and said, what do we have to do to stop the bombing? And he said, simply stop it. And if you wish, you can have troops from the Organization for Security and Cooperation come into Kosovo and ensure that the refugees can come back home and we can get back to normal mm-hmm. normal life. He didn't want NATO troops there.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a UN resolution.
Surprise.
brought the end to the bombing. Mm-hmm. It was Resolution 1244, and that resolution clearly stated that reaffirmed Serbia's sovereignty over Kosovo. And, of course, that was totally ignored, and the KLA took over and became the Kosovo Protection Force.
Yes.
Almost all of the remaining Serbs, Jews, and Roma people were ethnically cleansed by the new Albanian rulers. And then in 2008, without any kind of a referendum, again, under U.S. urging, the Albanian leader in Kosovo, Thaçi, declared unilateral independence. As I said, before, and I've repeated it, the criticism that came from Russia was very strong, and Putin said, don't do this, and if you do it, you set a precedent because of your violation of the Charter and international law and the Helsinki Final Accord that I will take note of, because I have some Russian minorities in parts of the former Soviet Union that I might want to see rejoin Russia. So no one should be surprised at what happened in the Crimea.
Yes, and by the way, you must have been surprised. This is James Bissett, by the way, former ambassador to Yugoslavia, longtime servant in the Foreign Ministry of Canada. You must have been surprised that the Harvard man, Obama, actually said into a microphone, there was a referendum in Kosovo.
Yes, I was. I was surprised.
That's astonishing.
Because there was no referendum in Kosovo. Yeah. It was a unilateral declaration.
I mean, it shows how embarrassed, I suppose, he must have been at having to discuss Crimea and have someone else say, oh, by the way, Kosovo.
Well, that's right. That's right. And, you know, even before that, I mean, we had the Bosnia, which was had Izet Begovic, the Muslim leader in Bosnia, had a majority, and he wanted to break away from Yugoslavia. And of course, the Christian Serbs did not want to, so there was a referendum in Bosnia, and Izet Begovic lost the referendum. And having lost the referendum, he was persuaded by the European community to sign an agreement with the other religious groups, Serbs and the Croats, Orthodox Serbs and Roman Catholic Croats, to sign an agreement with those three religious groups that if there was a time when Bosnia became independent, that those three groups would have autonomy. And that was signed in Lisbon in March of 92, as I recall. Having signed that agreement, my neighbor, who was the U.S. ambassador, he lived across the street from me. I used to play tennis with him a lot. He flew to Sarajevo and asked Izet Begovic, why did you sign this silly agreement in Lisbon? Why don't you just declare unilateral independence? And we, the United States, will fully support you.
You're telling him they would support, right?
Yeah,
I mean, by the way, that's the dangerous area, right? I mean, where behavior of that type by the ambassador, that becomes an instigation. You're actually inciting someone to do something which is improper.
Well, absolutely, and not only that, I mean, Izet Begovic said, but if I do that, we will have a civil war here, because the Serbs, who were about 39%, 40% of the population, or perhaps more, he said, will never live under a Muslim rule, as they had to do under the Turks for 600 years. Zimmerman said, if there's a civil war, the Americans will support you. And he declared unilateral independence. Inevitably, there was a civil war with 100,000 people killed. And who was blamed? Milosevic.
Well, that's what...
You know, I mean, but again, the Russians took note of this, here's NATO and the you know, the Western powers.
It's called Two Can Play That Game, right?
That's right. And the double standard has been set, really, by NATO ever since the end of the Cold War.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask you, because this is my great opportunity to do, I've been wondering about this, and because it seems to be associated with your just telling us, and that is this matter of withdrawing recognition of countries and closing embassies. Isn't it an incitement to trouble to say, we don't recognize your government?
Yeah.
You're basically telling the population and any expatriate who wants to organize a little army that it's all the same difference to you.
Absolutely. And it's a provocative act, really. It's almost a first step to before a declaration of war. But even more seriously, it almost prohibits or makes impossible the idea that you can resolve these disputes peacefully if you close down the embassy and have nothing to do with it, then you're closing that off completely. We didn't even do that at the height of the Cold War. We maintained diplomatic relations with the Soviet Union. We traded with them, and we had dialogue with them. And quite frankly, the relationship between the West and Russia in the 70s was much healthier and better than it is today. I mean, if you think of it, how absolutely outrageous and stupid it is that we have fighting going on in Ukraine, people being killed, and armaments building up, and, you know, the Poles thinking they're going to be bombed by Putin, and the Latvians that are going to be invaded. And all of that is simply pure propaganda. I mean, the Russians have no intention of invading Latvia, Lithuania, or Estonia, and they certainly aren't going to invade or bomb Poland. This is a figment of NATO's imagination, but it's deliberately designed to ensure that Russia does not become a world power again and rival the hegemony of the United States.
Yeah. So, and we're speaking to former Ambassador James Bissett. And that raises this issue of what is happening in our own political environment, because we do have a parliamentary system, and one expects opposition parties and others to address these matters. But, and when one thinks of Canada, we can't claim we're a superpower. I guess the term is often middle power. And the role of middle powers historically has been diplomacy. I mean, isn't that the most valuable thing that we can bring, is we talk to all the parties, et cetera?
Well, absolutely it is, but I'm afraid this government has foreclosed on that. I mean, what we seem to be having now is foreign policy dominated by the size of the diaspora in the country. Mm-hmm. We saw that when the Prime Minister refused to attend the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in Sri Lanka, because he had 300,000 Tamils in the Greater Toronto Area who might take exception to that. So he didn't go. So he didn't have an opportunity of sitting down and discussing things in a sensible way.
Yeah, by the
now
way,
we have the Ukrainian situation.
I don't know why people assume that diplomacy is somehow betrayal. How it's simply engaging the other party, right?
Well, that's the way it's supposed to be, and that's normally the way it is. But and we saw an example of that recently in Ukraine, actually, where the German and French, I think it was, and I'm not sure if the Polish foreign minister, did resolve the protests that were going on in Maidan on the square in February the 21st. They met with the Yanukovych, the prime minister, the corrupt one, and the one who was that had allegedly caused the protests, with the opposition parties, and they reached an agreement, and people forget this, on February the 21st, an agreement that Yanukovych would remain prime minister, but would not make any decisions, that the people protesting, none of them would be prosecuted, that free and fair elections would be held, I think, in 3 months or 4 months, whatever. And that was settled, and a deal was struck.
Mm-hmm.
But because that deal did not satisfy the Americans, and because it had been negotiated by European diplomacy, they called in a bunch of thugs from Lviv, and started the protests again. And these protests, the following day on February 22nd, led to deaths. There were shootings. Mm-hmm. And police were killed, and so were others. That has never been investigated thoroughly. But there's a high degree of suspicion that it was done deliberately.
Well, and certainly after the violence, they didn't return to the agreement.
No, they didn't return to the agreement.
And by the way, a very powerful, or at least a well-known personage from Poland, Mr. Sikorski, he was on record as being very firm that this had to be respected.
Yeah, well.
And it's just gone by the boards.
It's gone by the boards, and you see, here again, you see a double standard. I mean, the reason we decided to go in and take Gaddafi out was because he was threatening to kill and bomb his own people.
Mm-hmm.
The reason we were got into involvement in Syria, and to some degree we are now involved there, was because of that the leader Bashar was killing his own people. But when the Ukrainians
kill their own people,
start killing their own people, and they, you know, during the Maidan protests, about 80 people were killed, total casualties.
Mm-hmm.
The coup d'etat, putting the Americans' choices of prime minister into power in Kiev, the eastern provinces of Ukraine decided that they didn't want to have anything to do with that, and they had their own kind of referendum to declare independence, upon which the Ukrainian army led by some really hard-nosed extreme militia called the Azov Battalion in the Right Sector started shelling and bombing these people, and still are to some degree.
Yeah, there's a great danger that'll be lost. I assume you must be concerned that these Minsk agreements, there is one in place called Minsk II, but
yeah.
I don't hear our politicians, although Mr. Mulcair has indicated he sees a little bit of a legal problem here, but Minsk II has to be implemented, or otherwise we're going to have hell to pay there.
Well, exactly, and there's a suspicion, of course, that the truce was agreed upon only to give the Ukrainian army time enough to get trained and equipped by the Americans and the Canadians now to the point where they can then take on these people in eastern Ukraine, Donetsk and Lugansk.
Not a pretty picture.
Let's hope that doesn't happen, but there's serious, I mean...
Well, by the way, your article, I really hope people go to the writings. We're speaking to former Ambassador James Bissett, and we live in this lovely internet world where you just put James Bissett's name in and you'll find three or four really excellent articles. I'd call them a little handbook on what diplomacy is, what international law is.
Well, you know, I was a Cold War warrior. I mean, you know, those of us who lived through the...
You didn't wear camouflage, though. You were just a Cold Warrior.
But, I mean, we all looked... I mean, here was a historic turning point. When the Soviet Union imploded and collapsed, there was a great sigh of relief throughout all of Europe and North America that the Cold War had come to an end.
Yeah.
I mean, we didn't all go so far as Tsukiyama saying that it was the end of history, but everybody felt a great sense of relief that the possibility of a nuclear holocaust had almost disappeared. And instead of taking full advantage of that and helping Russia recover from the cataclysmic event of the collapse of the ideology, but the economy and everything else went to pot. Mm-hmm. Instead of helping them, as we did with the Germans with the Marshall Plan and the Japanese after the bomb, we didn't do that. And in fact, the Americans made a point of ensuring that Russia would not once again rise to become a world power. And there, to understand American policy since then, I think you have to really take a look at a planning document, it was called, a defense planning document that was written in 1992 in the Pentagon. And basically it said, and I'm paraphrasing, that the United States is now going to have complete world power. It's the new American century, as they described it. And we have dominance now, and we must ensure that no other country will rise to rival us. And they singled out areas of where they're...
Well, they've even developed the language, right? I mean, really, shouldn't Canada, together with powers like, I should call it, Sweden, Norway, and others, say, you know, we don't have indispensable nations on the earth, right?
Yeah.
That language introduced by Madeleine Albright and others, they actually insist on that. I don't... It seems appalling that... Couldn't we, as a friendly neighboring state, say, oh, by the way, we'd appreciate if you didn't say that kind of thing?
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, the terminology you say was, you know, pretty shocking.
It's actually an affront to Canada. I don't know why we worry about other kinds. I mean, it's an affront to any other sovereign state.
Yeah. Oh, yes, because in that planning document, and you can get it on the web, too, and read it, it's pretty revealing. Let me just read one paragraph. I have it in front of me. We endeavor to prevent any hostile power from dominating a region whose resources would be sufficient to generate global power. West Europe, East Asia, the former Soviet Union territory, and West Asia. Mm-hmm. And it said its primary goal, however, is, quote, to prevent the reemergence of a new rival either on the territory of the former Soviet Union or elsewhere that poses a threat on the order of that formerly posed by the Soviet Union.
My goodness.
And that document it was written in 1992, and it explains a lot of what happened in Yugoslavia, later on in Iraq, and what's happening now in Ukraine.
Yeah, that would be the subtext of the expression from George Bush, the New World Order, right?
Absolutely, the New World Order.
And then,
full spectrum dominance was another phrase they used. full-spectrum dominance.
Full-spectrum. I remember when I first read that, I thought, my goodness, that's a rather naked expression. You're a trained diplomat. You would know it. Words like that jump off the page, don't they?
Well, I mean, it was a historic moment, and they screwed it up. Let me put it that way. Instead of having Americana.
Yeah, they certainly screwed it up for the rest of us.
Well, they certainly did.
This is James Bissett. I want to make sure I ask you one more thing here just to clarify what's going on in Syria. There's a kind of odd language that's developed in discussing Assad. They say, we are now going to bomb the bad guys we've picked out in Syria. And then the editorialists say, well, they're working with Assad. But Assad doesn't say they're working. He says, you didn't ask my permission.
That's right.
Would you clarify? He's not giving the green light to anybody to do anything. He's just being ignored. His sovereignty has already been taken away from him.
That's right, yes. No, he certainly is not. I mean, in Iraq, where we are there and we're helping, and one might question that as well, but the fact is we're not breaking international law by being there because the Iraqis have indeed invited us there and are happy to have us there.
Yeah, and if they're inviting, that means they join in strategy, tactics, and deployment of forces, right?
That's right. That's right. But that's not the case in Syria, no. What we're doing in Syria is a violation of international law, and it's once again broken the charter.
Well, I noticed that Tunisia has said they want to reopen their embassies with Syria. I wish that was other countries would pick up that idea. It would pose a possibility of a negotiated solution.
Yeah, I mean, the Middle East is a dreadful mess, and that's the other implication that I am concerned about, or I'm not happy about, is that we, by breaking our promises with Russia, because after the Cold War and the Germans wanted a united Germany into NATO, the Russians, quite understandably, were not happy about the idea of a united Germany again, becoming part of a military organization, which people must realize that is what NATO is. Mm-hmm. But they made a deal, George Bush's father made a deal with Gorbachev, that if the Russians allowed united Germany, then NATO would never expand eastward.
Mm-hmm.
And despite a lot of his advisors telling Gorbachev not to trust the Americans, he did trust them. But on NATO's 50th birthday in Washington, during the bombing of Serbia, Bill Clinton, who was the president, made two very important announcements. The first one was that NATO can no longer abide by the idea that it's a defensive organization. And therefore, from now on, he gave a new role for NATO. And he announced it in Washington on the 50th birthday party. NATO will now be able to intervene militarily wherever and whenever we decide it should do so.
Mm-hmm.
To hell with Article 1. You never hear anyone in NATO ever mention Article 1 anymore. But it is there, and it's part of a treaty.
So, Article 1.
The other announcement he made was that NATO is inviting and admitting Hungary, the Czech Republic, and Poland into NATO.
Mm-hmm.
And we know what's happened since then. NATO has completely surrounded Russia. The two prizes they still haven't quite got was Georgia, although they came close, and Ukraine. And that's what's going on in Ukraine now, is a proxy war, basically, between the United States and Russia.
And I'm really glad you remind us that it's not the neocons, as people call them, but it's Bill Clinton.
Bill Clinton did it.
He did it, and I assume that we can assume that his... Should his wife become president, she probably would be cut from the same cloth.
She'll be worse.
Yeah.
I met some of these people during my time as ambassador, and some of these people had what happened there? They lost their moral authority.
Mm-hmm.
They were thugs in many ways. Madeleine Albright, Wesley Clark, these people didn't really believe in the principles and the rule of law and democracy. They wanted power, and They lost, as I said, I think in the article, that the United States lost its moral authority, and we will lose ours and have to a degree if we keep breaking international law. It's the only thing that's going to save the planet. Mm-hmm. And the stupidity of the fighting that's going on now in Ukraine, it has nothing to do with the Ukrainian people. They will be the losers here. They're not going to gain anything. And if any Ukrainian, and I know many of my friends that are critical of me because I seem to be pro-Russian, if any of my Ukrainian friends or any Ukrainians listening today think that what's going on in Ukraine is done by the Americans because they have altruistic reasons and sympathies with the Ukrainian people, if they're pipe dreaming, they're not in the slightest bit interested, and they're destroying Ukraine, and it's going to have a hard time, if ever, to recover what it had prior to this this nonsense that's going on.
Yeah.
The other, I hate to just keep on ranting here, but the other thing that's very serious in my view is that we have totally alienated Russia.
Yeah.
And Russia always has been, and probably always will be, a great power. Mm-hmm. And we've got to the point where Putin is turning his back on Europe.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to become part of Europe. They were told, basically, sorry, we don't want you. So mm-hmm. now he's turned away. And despite the sanctions, he signed agreements with China, with India, with Brazil. And he is taking Russia away from Europe, and I think that's a tragic mistake, because mm-hmm. in the future, we need Russia. Russia is part of Europe, and it can be one of our great allies, quite apart from one of our biggest economic partners, particularly in the north.
Yes.
But we can't do that if you consider the leader of the Russians a thug. He may be a thug, but you shouldn't tell him he is, and you shouldn't be putting troops in his neighbor's country, in the neighboring country, in Ukraine, as we are doing.
Yeah. Well, James Bissett, you couldn't have summed it up more nicely. Thank you very much. And this is an excellent article. I say your articles provide us with an instrument for solving these problems. And I thank you very, very much for being with us. I hope we can talk to you sometime in the future.
Well, I apologize for my rant, but
I didn't find it a rant at all. It sounded like a lawyer with a brief in front of him. It was pretty good.
Well, I mean, the other thing that bothers me, just on this closing note, the media, the Western media, the mainstream media, are really playing a terrible role here now on what's happening in Ukraine. We're only getting one side of the issue here. We don't, and you know, there's the same old story of demonizing making Putin into a villain, as they did with Milosevic, with Saddam Hussein, with Gaddafi, with Bashar, the whole story again.
There's a lot of Orwell in that.
There is indeed.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
That's James Bissett, and he knows his stuff, doesn't he?